You're listening to a podcast edition of Closer to Truth. For more information about this series, visit our website, closertotruth.com.
Hi, I'm Robert Lawrence Kuhn, host of Closer to Truth, the global resource on cosmos consciousness and meaning. We're pleased to partner with the Institute of Art and Ideas again this year for How the Light Gets In, the world's largest music and philosophy festival taking place May 26th to 29th. To prepare for the big event, we've created a video playlist of interviews with Closer to Truth contributors who will be at the festival, including Roger Penrose, Dan Dennett, Christoph Koch, Simon Blackburn, and Hilary Lawson. Find Closer to Truth on YouTube to explore the playlist and register for a free membership at closertotruth.com for subscriber exclusives, early access to new episodes, and much more. For almost 25 years, Closer to Truth has pursued cosmos, consciousness, and meaning. Meaning has focused on philosophy of religion, and I approach theism, atheism, and agnosticism with equal parts passion and skepticism. While Closer to Truth has explored big questions of meaning in depth, questions of existence, God, human nature, purpose, if any, Closer to Truth viewers would not be mistaken if they have detected a bias favoring philosophers of the Christian religion. Let's be charitable and call this Christian philosophy bias an overweighting. The product of my unchosen geography and my analytical proclivities. We have tried to include Buddhist and Hindu philosophy, but we have not tried hard enough. And we have not at all considered Chinese philosophy, Confucianism, and Taoism. I am excited to expand the scope of our search, explore big questions from the perspective of Buddhism, Hinduism, Confucianism, and Taoism. This is the first episode of Closer to Truth season dedicated to Eastern traditions and the big questions. In Eastern traditions, what is world? What is reality? I'm Robert Lawrence Kuhn, and Closer to Truth is my journey to find out. Take the big questions of the existence of the world and the nature of human beings. What is ultimate reality? Is there a creator God? What is the human person? Why is there evil and suffering? Is there life after death? And if so, what kind of life? What is the world to come? I approach the philosophies of diverse religions in two ways. This may sound contradictory, please hear me out. Both seeking insights, depth of thought, flow of argument, and applying tough-minded critical thinking. Here's my plan for Eastern traditions and the big questions. I explore the big questions from the perspective of each major tradition. To begin, the fundamentals of the world, the foundations of reality. I start with a devout Buddhist practitioner and philosopher. A Buddhist nun with a master's in comparative philosophy and a doctorate in religious studies from Yale, Venerable Yi Fa.
From my appearance, everybody can tell I'm a Buddhist nun. And religion, people will say it will be my faith. But grow up in Taiwan, we were already taught Confucianism and Taoism from elementary school to high school. And my family faith believe in so-called the Ma Zhu. It's kind of more like a folk religion. The first one, Confucianism, focus on this life and say, okay, 敬鬼神而远之. You respect all the ghosts and deity, but not worship them. And Taoism uses so-called the Tao. The Tao, many people translate the way or the path, but I think it's beyond that. Means the way of the natural function.
Ineffable.
Ineffable. Like you cannot say it, isn't it? Or inconceivable. And very interesting, when Buddhism came to China. And when Buddhism talk about the Shixiang, the ultimate reality, is also inconceivable. And so that's kind of led Buddhism and the Taoism kind of working together much better. But Buddhism has called two truths.
Yeah.
One is called ultimate truth.
Yeah.
So that might be, you know, get along with the Taoism better.
Yeah.
But it also called about conventional truth.
In Buddhism, what are the fundamental precepts that drive the religious thinking?
I think it's about the causality. So if people come to ask, what is the difference of like a Buddhism, then the Buddhism will say causality. Cause, conditions, result, and retribution. So the things always have the cause and condition that then they come to be. And that was why also the karma come in. The cause and condition.
And that karma is...
If cause and conditions are fundamental principles of Buddhism, what are its philosophical foundations? I ask a philosopher of mind and metaphysics who specializes in Buddhist studies, Jay Garfield.
As I answer that question, I'm going to be answering it firmly within the Mahayana tradition. So the three ideas, one is impermanence, one is interdependence, and the third one is emptiness of any intrinsic nature. When we say that things are impermanent, we mean that from moment to moment, everything is constantly changing. And so impermanence literally means that we have a new world every moment that drives Buddhist thought. When we talk about dependent origination or interdependence, that is typically explained as having three principal dimensions. One is causal interdependence. The second is myriological interdependence. When we say myriological, we mean that any whole depends for its existence on its parts. Mm-hmm. But the Buddhist twist is that every part also depends for its identity on the whole. So this is reciprocal. On the Buddhist view, everything arises depending on causes and conditions and goes out of existence when those causes and conditions are no longer present. It connects to momentariness, right? Because it means that for something to remain or to change, there's got to be a cause for its remaining or for its changing. But it also means that when we try to explain what something is, we need to explain it as the effect of other things and the thing that causes other things. That is, identity is partly constituted by causal relations. The third that's following from that is emptiness of intrinsic identity. And in the Madhyamaka school, when we say that things are empty, we say they're empty of any intrinsic identity. We could also think of that as essence, something that makes the thing that it is, a kind of central core. When we recognize that those things are constantly changing, impermanence, and when we recognize that they only have those properties in virtues of causes and conditions, we see those properties aren't intrinsic to those things, and it makes us see them differently. Emptiness is not non-existence. It's therefore identical with interdependence in this way.
Buddhism arose in India. How did it spread across Asia? I ask a Japanese, Australian, British, American philosopher of mind and religion, the leader of the Global Philosophy of Religion Project, Yujin Nagasawa.
Each tradition offers an interesting fundamental metaphysical view. And coming from Japan, I'm quite interested in Buddhism and Shintoism and compare them. In Buddhism, you have a very dynamic view of reality. So Buddhists claim that there are three marks of existence. So suffering, non-self, and impermanence. And this is quite distinct from the Western concept, because in the Western theistic tradition, there is God who is eternal and necessarily existent, and there's the permanent self, the eternal soul, and so on. But in Buddhism, everything is constantly changing. If there are gods and angels, they are impermanent as well. And in Shinto, there is also a dynamic view of reality, but the focus is not necessarily on impermanence, but it's more on this vital energy that is immanent in the world. Shintoism is an indigenous religion in Japan, so it has been existent for much longer time than Buddhism in Japan. But the Buddhism came from India via China to Japan. And you know, some philosophers, they try to figure out how we can understand these distinct religious traditions, which appear to be incompatible. But what's interesting is people try to accept both of them at the same time. And there is a theory called Honji Suijak theory, which basically says that these Buddhas or Buddhist deities, they came to Japan, but when they came to Japan, they manifested themselves as Shinto gods so that the Japanese people can easily accept the teaching of Buddhism. And some other people had the opposite theory, saying that actually Shinto gods, they manifested themselves as Buddhist deities. So some people think that Shinto gods or Shinto kami, they are more fundamental or more prior to Buddhist deities. But some people think of it the other way around. And you can also find kami everywhere. There are gods of rivers and mountains and trees and rocks and even gods of artificial objects.
And these gods are real supernatural things, or are they kind of metaphors?
That's a tricky issue, because sometimes real people, when they die, they can be kind of promoted to kami, but also there are more kind of non-human kami as well.
But are they concrete objects, even though they're non-physical?
That's another difficult question. I mean, they are not meant to be conscious beings like humans or animals. They are kind of meant to be somewhat abstract.
Whereas Buddhism, the world's fourth largest religion, arose on the Indian subcontinent about 2,500 years ago, Hinduism, the world's third largest religion, arose there well earlier. I meet a Hindu monk who leads the Vedanta Society of New York, Swami Sarvapriyananda.
I'll talk about the school I'm most familiar with, my home tradition, which is non-dual Vedanta, Advaita Vedanta. The answers are pretty elegant and simple. Ultimate reality, consciousness, God, one word is enough, Brahman. But Brahman literally means the vast, the limitless, the vast in the sense of the limitless. If you dig a little deeper, you will find it described as existence, consciousness, bliss, sat, chit, ananda. Limitless existence, limitless consciousness, limitless bliss. One easy way of understanding this is when we look at the broad divisions of philosophy, metaphysics or ontology would be one where we ask, what is real? Then we ask, how do we know? Epistemology. And then we ask, what's good, what's worthwhile, what's valuable, beautiful? So that now we have a new term for that, axiology. If you look at the characterization of ultimate reality, this is a direct answer to each of these three questions. What is real? And the answer is sat, pure being. Being itself is real. Existence itself is real. How do we know anything at all? How do we experience anything at all? The answer is consciousness, chit. Chit means pure consciousness, awareness, consciousness. And then what's the point of it all? What's good? What's valuable? Is there anything meaningful here? And the answer is ananda, which means bliss. When we think about existence, we think about existing things, tables and chairs and people and sky and the earth, maybe even in some sense Harry Potter and the number one or something like that. What Vedanta does is it reverses this. It says, think of existing things like waves in an ocean, and think of existence as the water. So we are surrounded by an ocean of existence, and you encounter it as existing, you know, just as existence itself is not an existing thing, but all existing things are existence. Mm-hmm. Similarly, consciousness itself is not a thought or a feeling or an emotion or an idea or a pain or a pleasure. Rather, it is that which enables us to have these experiences of thoughts and feelings and emotions and all. Similarly, bliss is not a happy feeling or a nice emotion. Rather, it is that which is all of this, as one commentator says, they are the spray from the ocean of bliss, which is ananda, which is you yourself. If you wanted to summarize the teaching of Advaita Vedanta, it's very simple, one sentence, tat tvamasi, that thou art, you are that. That is pure being, existence, consciousness, bliss. And when we investigate ourselves, we come to see that we are this unlimited existence, consciousness, bliss.
Non-dualism, Brahman, from Advaita Vedanta, means that all is interconnected and that all is pure being and pure consciousness. For another perspective, I meet a Hindu monk who is a philosopher with a doctorate in German idealism from Berkeley, Swami Mehrananda.
There are many traditions within Hinduism which are devotional in nature, which means that they conceive the ultimate reality as personal in nature, the personal God with omni attributes, who responds to our prayers, who creates, preserves, and destroys the universe. There's another school of Hinduism called Advaita Vedanta, the school of non-dualism within Vedanta, which was codified by the great 8th century philosopher Shankaracharya. His view is almost the diametrical opposite, and he conceives ultimate reality as non-dual and impersonal pure consciousness. And he says that that's our true nature. And then the question is, well, what about this world? And what about us as individual souls? What about the personal God? He says, they're all true, but from the provisional or empirical standpoint. But when the moment that you realize the highest truth, which is non-dual pure consciousness, all of those things, the world, individual souls, and the personal God, turn out to be illusory. The tradition of Hinduism that I follow can be traced to the 19th century Bengali mystic Sri Ramakrishna, taught that God is infinite and actually manifests in different forms to different spiritual aspirants. And so the spiritual tradition I adhere to is one that follows what I would call a both-and approach, rather than what I would consider the either-or approach favored by most of the traditional schools of Hinduism. And why not both and? Why not say that the ultimate reality in one aspect is non-dual pure consciousness, and in another aspect, the personal God, which can manifest in different forms?
But is one more fundamental than the other? I don't think you can have it both ways.
I think it's coherent to say that the one infinite divine reality can be impersonal in one aspect and personal in another aspect, but without saying that one is more fundamental than the other.
But if it's at all personal, then it is personal.
Absolutely.
If the ultimate reality, and there's nothing more fundamental, is personal, then even if some think it's not personal, but that it really is personal.
The precise relationship between non-dual pure consciousness and the personal gods would be to say that what's absolutely bedrock fundamental is non-dual pure consciousness, and that the different forms of the personal God are grounded in that non-dual substrate.
That to me is more coherent. Whether it's right or not, that's another question.
Yeah.
I'm looking for what is absolutely.
Absolutely. Or what the afterlife looks like. Ramakrishna distinguishes between two paradigms of eschatology. One is eating sugar and the other is becoming sugar. Yeah. So what he means is, devotees of the personal God, for them, the goal is to dwell in an eternal heaven in a loving relationship with the personal God in the form that they love. And that's not going to be sublated or abolished at some later stage in eschatology. Yeah. But that an equally valuable form of salvation is becoming sugar, by which he means the goal of Advaita Vedanta, which is there's no coming and going. There are no heavens that you dwell in. It's all sort of too dualistic for the school of non-dualism. So what they say is all you do is rest in your true nature, which is non-dual pure consciousness.
I embrace the fundamental tension in Indian non-dualism, without a personal God or with, and its resonance in the afterlife, either being sugar, only consciousness exists, there is no God, or eating sugar, God and consciousness both exist. I know that Chinese traditions are quite different. The practical worldliness of indigenous Chinese philosophy, Confucianism and Taoism, is clear. But how to distinguish the two? I speak with an expert in ancient Chinese philosophy, the editor of the journal Philosophy East and West, Franklin Perkins.
The quickest way to get the picture of what's going on with the early Chinese philosophy, at least, is just to point out how this-worldly it is. So no one proposed that this world was an illusion. No one thought there was some eternal reality that was different from this world that one could try to seek. They don't even think that there's a being, a God separate from the world that would create the world. So everything is focused on this world. So the religious aspects, a kind of reverence, it's always going to be toward things that are either a being in this world or an aspect of this world or maybe the whole world itself. The meaning of life is going to come from nature. So for the early period, you know, there were hundreds of different philosophers. Yeah, it's a little hard to make sense of it. In the Han Dynasty, looking back, Sima Qian grouped it into six schools. So of those, the ones that we know of are Confucianism and Taoism. They're still around.
What are the core characteristics between those two?
The core of Confucianism is social roles, how we can take our natural desires and emotions and reconcile that with all the demands that social life places on us. So the question really is, like, what kind of self should you become? And what kind of world do you want to make, right? How do you end up with a fulfilling, happy life that still lets you do all the things you should do for other people? Taoism is almost the opposite direction of that. Taoism is much more aligning with nature, based on an idea that nature itself is not that bad, right? So they don't have like a very idealized view of nature, but they do think it tends to be harmonious, sustainable, moderate, balanced. And so a human life that fits in with nature will have those qualities. So there again, there's lots of different ways to do that. The more radical way is to try to accept whatever happens and just go along with whatever happens, freeing yourself from desires, from emotions that you find in the Zhuangzi. Right. The Tao Te Ching, what's most interesting about it to me really is how it produces so much meaning.
Well, which big questions are important?
I think it's in the shadow of an idea that nature is not supporting our normal human ethics. So one way to relate to that would be to say we should transcend our normal ethical categories, go along with the way things are. That's the Zhuangzi, the Taoist text. I think that's the direction it takes. Mengzi, who's maybe my favorite, thinks that we follow the nature that's in us, which leads us to be good, even though nature itself isn't good. So what's natural for us is to want peace, to not want innocent people to die. What's natural for nature doesn't necessarily involve those things, right? But he says you follow the internal drives of yourself. You start to get a new idea late in the Warring States period, and then that becomes really dominant in the Han period, that's looking more at the patterns of nature and then making analogies between those patterns and the patterns of human society. It's often called correlative cosmology, because there's all these correlations between it.
From Buddhism's impermanence and emptiness, to Hinduism's non-dualism and consciousness, to Chinese philosophy's practical worldliness and ethics, are there integrative principles that characterize Eastern traditions? I ask a philosopher of cognitive science and of religion, who studies how humans form abstract beliefs, Helen De Cruz.
In Neo-Confucianism, you have the idea that humans do have a self, but the self is part of a bigger picture. And the metaphor that they take from Buddhism is the metaphor of Indra's net, where you have the world is just like a net, and each individual object in the world, you know, like, say, this piano or you, are like individual like intersections or jewels in the net. And so the idea is that if you think about the world, then you have to think about how we are situated within that world and how our perceptions influence the world. And you see this particularly in most strands of Buddhism. Westerners will then often sort of go like, yeah, but what's real? What's really behind this all? Like, ooh, that is a scary thought. But in Eastern religious traditions and philosophies, seems like people are more comfortable with that. Like the idea that the world is not what it seems, that it's limited by our perceptions. For example, in Neo-Confucianism, you have the idea that there is sort of physical stuff that is also mindful, namely qi. And then you have like the pattern of the world or the li, and those two things interrelate with each other. And then they use that metaphysical picture to think about concretely about how we should act, because the universe is not a morally neutral place. The universe has certain moral properties too. You know, Westerners will often say like, this is the cosmology, and then this is the ethics, and they're two different things. But in many Eastern traditions, these two hang together. If you know what the pattern of the universe looks like, then you also know that there is a fact of the matter about how you can act. So, for example, one of the things that particularly Buddhism has is the idea that selfish desires sort of cloud our judgment. They cloud our thinking, and they cloud our realization that we are all interconnected.
And that, you know, Eastern traditions broadly have a world that is interconnected, where metaphysics and morality are deeply related. In Buddhism, causality is crucial. Conditions, results, consequences. Likewise, impermanence, interdependence, and emptiness of intrinsic existence. In Shintoism, vital energy is imminent in the world, and hard-to-describe gods, called kami, are everywhere. In Hinduism, the one word Brahman is ultimate reality, limitless existence, cosmic consciousness, God. Whether pure non-dualism, where only consciousness is real and all else is illusion, or non-dualism with a personal God, who creates, preserves, and destroys the universe, or a mystical both-and approach. In Confucianism, what counts is what happens in this world, self, family, society, state, ethics, and morality. In Taoism, what counts is alignment with nature, harmony, sustainability, balance. The down-to-earth practicality of Chinese philosophy contrasts with the abstract metaphysics of Hinduism, even of Buddhism. And as always, within each tradition, there are great variations. This Closer to Truth miniseries, Eastern Traditions and the Big Questions, widens our perspective of existence, consciousness, meaning, which we need to hope to get closer to truth.
To watch complete conversations with over 100 of the world's leading thinkers on cosmos, consciousness, and meaning, visit our website, closertotruth.com.